I really believe that I have become a designer because my wish is to make a difference for people, somehow to nurture them a little and make them feel that the world is an okay place. I want to send out good energy through my colors. I believe in love and curiosity and exchanging with people.
That was Margrethe Aalgaard, and this is Nordic Portraits. Margrethe Aalgaard is a color and textile designer and artist who over the past two decades has established herself as Scandinavia's leading expert in color. In 2013, she founded her own studio and has since collaborated with visual artists, musicians, chefs, fashion designers, and leading design brands such as Muto, Hay, and Georg Jensen. In 2016, Margrethe received the prestigious Torsten Okvanja Söderbergs Prize, and in 2019 was named Denmark's Designer of the Year. Margrethe, welcome to Nordic Portraits.
Thank you for having me, Ben.
I wondered if we could start off by going back to 2019, Margrethe, where, whilst on holiday in Japan, one evening, brushing your teeth before going to bed, a certain encounter with a leaky faucet led to somewhat of an unexpected creative epiphany. And I'm curious, what did you discover that night?
Yeah, that's right. I was in Japan to study the culture, like I think many creatives are feeling drawn to. And I didn't really know my purpose of being there. I was walking around just letting myself be open and letting the culture sort of seep into my mind. And then during the last days before this evening, I had been absorbing the colors and how they were quite different from what I was used to, but I couldn't really put a finger on what the thing was. And then this specific evening, I was staying in a Homaiken with shared toilets, and the sink was dripping, and I bent down and saw this vision of tubes under the sink, a tube wrapped in baby rose and a tube wrapped in baby mint color and a turquoise knot. And I don't know about Australia and other cultures, but I know for sure that in Denmark, under a sink, you will meet rather dirty grayish or whitish tubes, not any color close to this. And it was really a point of no return for me because I realized, wow, somewhere in the Japanese culture, in the plumbing industry, someone pressed the button of light rose, light mint, and turquoise while they were coding what colors these tubes should be presented with. And it made me also realize that there is a difference in how we perceive and use colors in different cultures. I call it the cultural color identities of a given country or region. And in this case, it became a mission for me to investigate what's the difference between Japanese culture and how they use colors and combine colors as opposed to Scandinavian colors and how we use colors in our surroundings. So it became a journey that I embarked on this specific evening, collecting color combinations. And I just started walking around, observing colors in the surfaces of architecture and design specifically, not nature in this case. Obviously, nature is so beautiful and full of rich inspiration for everyone, but it's so obvious. And I was curious looking at something else. I was curious to understand the things behind a given culture that makes us combine colors as we do and what that will tell of a given culture. You know, as a designer, you often have to design for a specific market. So like when I worked in fashion design several years ago, I would be given the task of, hey, today, Margrethe, please design colors for Italian women or Japanese men or elderly women and men from the US. Or there's always markets that you have to meet. And as a color designer, knowing the impact of color and how important the color choices are, at this time, I was concerned with, you know, getting better at choosing the right colors that would actually go out there and work in the given context.
So what do these color palettes tell us about a culture? For example, if we were to take Japan, what did you discover about why they express themselves the way they do with color?
for this specific journey, I didn't know what it told me. So I decided to continue the research and travel to other continents over the next 3 years. So I also went to Morocco to collect color combinations and to Iceland. And it wasn't actually until the last trip to Iceland that I started understanding what I was discovering. And what I discovered was, I think it's not really anything that's like a genius insight, but it made me understand thoroughly how nature and how the light conditions of our surroundings actually affect the way that we see and perceive and select and work with colors in a culture. And even if you look at the ground under our feet, you will also see a clue. Like in Morocco, the ground was saturated red or yellow tones, and we had the direct sun from midday creating sharp and black, deep shadows. And the colors were similar, like saturated and with bold contrast in hue and in light and shadow. Whereas in Japan, quite similar to Denmark in many ways, there was a lot more indirect light and softer tones of the grounds and softer tones of their general palettes. And it was a little sort of obvious to me. So I didn't really understand it until Iceland, which was actually quite a revelation, because in Iceland, I would walk around in the cities of Reykjavik and Hofor in northern Iceland. And most of the buildings I met were quite dull, reduced, and sort of very shaded or tinted. And then suddenly around one corner, poof, like I remember there was a smyk house, like cyan, magenta, yellow, and black. Someone literally just took the offset and painted a house that color, or a bold turquoise house with a bright blue roof. So there was a feeling that a lot of the time in Iceland, the buildings were quite harmonious, and then suddenly it would break out. And then I actually became quite frustrated. It was really difficult to collect the color schemes of these cities as opposed to in Morocco and Japan, where I was carried by fascination. But on the last day, I suddenly understood that the nature of the colors of these Icelandic cities were very close to how nature is in Iceland in terms of the volcanoes. Like if suddenly out of the blue, poof, you have a volcano. Or it doesn't happen often, but there's an awareness. It could happen. And that's what's important. And there's also, you know, you have the beautiful clear day and then boom, you have a storm coming in. So the sudden shift in weather conditions and the feeling that we're just small people on Earth and nature is so much stronger than we are. It's sort of also captured in their way of using colors, that they have the muted scheme of colors and then they have like this power of something happens. So a long answer to your question. But I think what I found out was that in order to understand a given culture's color scheme, I have to look at what kind of nature has shaped their cultural color identity. Hmm. And it actually has helped me to understand my own Nordic color scheme as well, because that's also specific for some reason. And it's difficult not to be blurred by trends and traditions and to actually understand by root the color scheme of Scandinavia.
Well, you talk with such incredible passion about other cultures and reflecting on your own upbringing in the Nordic region. I'm curious, you were born on an island in the northwest of Jutland.
Yeah.
Can you take us into what your childhood was like, and was curiosity something that was valued within your own family?
Yeah. I grew up on a farm, and it was a small farm, not particularly good at anything, but just, you know, keeping up our own household. And we had a private beach, and it was beautiful in so many ways. And I'm from a large family of many kids. So a lot of the time I was just left on my own playing around with myself and my siblings. And when I think back, I don't remember really anyone talking with me, asking me anything. And maybe that's why I built up such a large, a dream of to have dialogue going on. I'm really curious. And the way I grew up, I was just observing so much, and especially observing how people behave and how nature looks and all the energies exchanging around me. And then my family root is partly German and Romanian and Danish. So I also had this when the German family would come visit, it was like the world came to me And it was amazing in so many ways to, from a very early age, have the impression that the world is open and there's other ways to do things. It's not like the way we do things in our family, in our household, is the way to do it. There's also other ways you can live your life, other languages you can speak, other kind of food you can eat. So from as far as I remember back, I just knew I have to leave. I have to see the world. And I think it might sound a little strange, but I think for some reason I grew up with a sort of love for people. Like, I have so much love within me and care. I really believe that I have become a designer because my wish is to make a difference for people, somehow to nurture them a little and make them feel that they are being caressed or taken care of and that the world is an okay place. And I want to send out good energies through my colors. And yes, I think it comes from when I was a small child. I believe in love and in curiosity and exchanging with people.
Hmm. Was it then difficult in your teenage years if you already felt this pull that you wanted to go explore the big wide world, but you were still living on a farm with many brothers and sisters?
It wasn't difficult, no, because I grew up kind of isolated in this remote island that not even Danes know, really.
What is the island called?
Thyholm, yeah. So when I was 13, I went to boarding school for 3 years. And from there, from when I was 16, I had my own apartment. I moved from home to a city 40 kilometers away from the family. And I actually remember those years, you know, the world just kept opening and opening. And I was so excited about it. And I was, just curious. And I was fortunate to be supported by teachers and adults around me from a quite early age. So I was carried, I think, out to the world. And every time I had the opportunity, I just moved to a bigger city.
So where did fashion first pique your interest? Because you knew already at a young age that you wanted to be a fashion designer. Can you remember when you were first drawn to that as a potential direction?
Well, the answer to that is I wasn't particularly drawn to fashion, but I was drawn to be creative and to create things. And at this point, I didn't even know it was for people. But when I was 18, I sat down and I didn't know what to apply for, but I knew it had to be something about creating. So I only saw three choices. I saw architect, artist, or designer. And in my mind, a designer was a fashion designer. So that's how young I was. So I sat down and I actually made pros and cons for all these three subjects. And the first one was architect. And today I'm a huge admirer of architecture and I really like to work with spaces and how they affect us. I think it's one of the most beautiful things you can create is the frames that surrounds our lives. But in my mind, it all came down to black and white and steel and concrete and glass. That's how far my imagination brought me at the age of 18. And also, I'm kind of a restless soul. So I knew that drawing a building and carrying it out would take several years. And I needed a little faster results than that. So I skipped architecture. And then artist, actually, that's what I thought I was going to apply for until the age of 18. And to some degree, I am an artist also today, but that's the important moment of my life when I sat down with the pros and cons. And there was all the pros of being able to create and colors and textures and the dialogue between creating and it will give some answers back to you and you have to listen, all this dynamic. But then I was like, I create a piece and so what? Someone will buy it and that's that. And then I suddenly realized, with design, there's another leg in the process. There's the human receiver. And there's the function. And by becoming a designer, I'll be able to create, but I will also activate the other part of me who cares a lot about people and how well they are. So this engaging social part of me were also activated here. So I chose to apply for design only. And that meant fashion design, because that's the only part of design I knew back then. And then when I entered, I changed to textiles a couple of years later.
And already in that period of studying textiles, you embarked upon this project that exists still today, which is the Color Diaries.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about what the nexus of the idea for that was and how that has informed your process since?
Yes, it's true. It's as far as I remember, it was during the second year in school that I kept a diary, a written diary at that time. And in the diary, we had some kind of talk that day where I learned that Coca-Cola has patented their red color. So in my diary, I'm writing, if it's possible to patent the color, someone must be quite particular about this red hue of the color. I actually didn't understand how you could patent the color, but it made me curious. And on that day, I wrote, I wonder if you can be such thing as a color designer. And by writing that, I think something crystallized in my mind, because I knew when you're a textile designer, the first thing you'll discover is how all the teachers are constantly touching what you're dressing. Like, oh, this quality is so soft. And so being a textile designer, you start actually experiencing your surroundings through your fingers and the tactility of surfaces and how well the color thrives in the surface. And at this point, it was something that captivated me a lot. So I decided, why not focus on becoming a color designer? Because when I looked on the internet and asked around, you know, there wasn't such titles. And then I decided, well, then I will be a color designer because that might be my thing to contribute with.
Mm. And this idea of documenting the colors that you experience through the color diary, I find that fascinating because one thing as I was preparing for this conversation was seeing a lot of video footage of you watching and looking. I know it sounds weird, but I really was intrigued by watching you watch, if that makes sense, yep. Because I'm so fascinated by how you're interpreting what you're seeing. And can you just provide a little insight into what it means to be constantly on the lookout for these color combinations and why it's important for you to document them and how often you reflect on that?
It has been quite a journey for me to learn to see without knowledge. And it's because back in school, I was sort of, you know, I got really good grades and it went well for me in school, but to a point where I realized after graduating from design university, a couple of years later even, I realized I'm thinking colors. I'm not sensing them. And I think it's a general problem in our part of the world that through schooling and through being educated, we start to analyze. We're so aware of thinking and processing and scheduling that we, to some point, start to just be in our minds instead of letting things happen. You know, I'm pointing now on my nose, but sensing things, or I could point on my stomach or between the hands, like being a body receiver for colors and our surroundings. So yeah, it was a couple of years after graduating, I realized I have to do something to move away from my mind and become a sensory human being and observing, I call it with naked eyes, instead of with conscious eyes. So I think for a decade, actually, I went to the color gym, is what I called it. And I made daily color notations in a diary. And I just was working very stubbornly on being able to observe colors without seeing what I thought I was seeing, but just observing without analyzing or thinking. Does it make sense what I'm saying?
Absolutely, it does. And I find it particularly interesting how you mentioned that as adults, we often lose that sense of curiosity and can be unwilling to strip away our own assumptions and see things for what they really are.
Yeah.
So having yourself been able to retrain your brain, do you feel now that you're in a position where you can look for inspiration and it's without any sort of bias or cerebral?
Oh, no, not at all. It's really actually like I have to have a conscious intention of getting rid of my intelligence, my mental disturbance. And just an example could be if you walk around in a building and you want to register the colors of the shadows. It's like you tend to just think there's a shadow and you make it grayish to some degree in your mind. And then when you actually start looking, it might be turquoise or rose or colored neutrals, but rarely just a gray. like pure gray. So that's how light is such a major player, and light is so shifting by nature. And we tend to just think light, shadow, dark, but not embracing all the tones of the shadow. And I do too. It's really just, I have to tell myself now, okay, Margrethe, so you think that way, but let's just forget about that and look again with naked eyes.
Wow. This probably sounds like a very fundamental or almost banal question, Margrethe, but how would you define color?
It's such a fundamental and important question, because color is light. It's the result of light meeting the surface. Color is the love child of light and material. And the thing is, and this is where things get really crazy, there isn't color in this world. The world is just surfaces and tactilities, and the colors are the result of light meeting the surface and how the surface is reflecting or observing colors. I think most of us, being a little curious about color, we know that. But when you think closer, like just take it in again and thinking that color happens in your, it's like how your eye interprets this sensation of light meeting the surface. And that, to me, explains why color is so powerful, because it's the result of light, and light is energy. The light waves come to us, meet our eyes, and is interpreted in our eyes' construction. So we read it as a specific shade of green, but it doesn't exist.
So if color is light and light is energy, presumably there's a lot to be said for the impact that color has on our emotions and on our daily well-being. Can you speak a little to that and what you've learned about that relationship through your own practice?
That's actually what I'm concerned about these years. I'm trying to be more able to navigate in this pool of emotions connected with color, because as we all know, colors are so interfering with our emotions and how we experience our surroundings. And that is also the reason why a lot of people are afraid of color and reluctant to use color in the surroundings and go for rather safe grays, black, white. So these years, I'm quite occupied trying to understand how we can build up some sort of understanding what specific colors and hues will do to our emotional system and nerve system. And you take the whole palette of how we function as human beings. And I've built up different workshop formats where I experiment with different fields of creativity, like architects or designers or musicians and fashion designers. And then I ask them to react on certain taste inputs and choose colors that they think best describe their taste input. And then I analyze the results. And this is quite interesting, actually, that I don't think I'll ever be able to conclude anything when it comes to color. It's too complex a medium. But I have come a few steps further in realizing that there's some things that are general for people. Like when I have the taste of sour, it's usually yellowish because we connect it with the fruit, lemon. So our connections and associations to color often come from nature, and again, light and shadow. So it will also be a long talk if I'm to go more into it. But I do hope that in 10 years from now, I'll be able to answer more precise on this question, because I think it's become my main focus as a color designer, actually, to try to understand a little better, and also to do some research or initiate others to do some research on how color affect our emotions.
The way that you describe color demonstrates just how important it is in terms of our own well-being, and also what a fundamental role it plays in design and art. But that wasn't always the case, that it was respected to the level that it is today. What was your experience when you were first stepping out of university and wanting to embark on this journey, specializing in something that perhaps wasn't as much on people's radars?
You're so right about that. I graduated in 2005, and my graduation was a celebration of the color brown.
Fantastic,
yeah. I deliberately chose a color that isn't usually that popular, because like a celebration of pink would be more obvious. But I graduated at a time where colors were not at all center of attention. And I didn't really care because I knew that I needed to focus on color. And also as a textile designer, it was more respected. So it was in society in general that no one really paid attention to all the qualities of color. But when I look back, it was also a time of WWW, World Wide Web. We had all these digital platforms coming in on us, and we had a lot of programs we had to understand and learn. And when I graduated in 2005, at least half of my fellow students didn't even have an email. I know that's strange, but it was a creative university. But still, when I look back, I think we were too occupied by measurements. We were so occupied by understanding what the computer meant and how we would navigate in that. We also just got cell phones. We had new ways of interacting and communicating. And in our architecture, we had new rendering programs. So everything was now drawn in programs and calculated, figured out beforehand. And usually there would be a natural hands-on process where you would go from idea to sampling, or you would draw by hand. And there was a big change in how we would develop things. And then we became quite good at all this, too good in many ways. And along the way, we spent more and more hours in front of the computer instead of working between our hands. And I was fortunate to sort of graduate at a time where I had a lot of work and I was out in the field working. And I slowly gained experience and became more and more skilled at the same time as we started to understand that we were getting maybe a little too technical and spending too much hours being digital. So from my perspective, the last few years have been a sudden awakening. We realized, wow, we actually don't feel well. We are worn out. We spend at least 3 hours a day in front of our phone. And then on top of that, we have backlit blue light, which is also very bad for your brain. And this has made us feel unwell as a society and has, from my perspective, made us turn towards all the body stuff, which means textiles, colors, being slow, creating food from scratch, and all these values of being present in the world. So many people have even started to plant dye their textiles at home and knit and I don't know, everything. And with this, I've also been fortunate to be trained to and experienced enough to embrace the new interest. So in that sense, I'm grateful for my journey because it's such a difficult topic, both textiles and colors. And actually, in many ways, it has been overseen and looked down on a little in our generation and maybe even a generation before that.
Do you feel that within the product world, I can see now that you're collaborating more and more with brands, is that a sign that they're waking up to the importance of thinking more carefully through the color combinations that they go to market with?
Yes, yes, definitely. I wish I could split myself into many because there's such a big interest and they actually know all these companies. We don't know how to work with colors and they aren't able to find that many that can tell them because it hasn't been a focus, like color has just been left in the corner of decoration and not really taken into consideration in education. So there is a lot of knowledge that's not been lost, but there's few people who are actually able to help them. And it's a shame, I think, in many ways, because again, it's so important for the user and for our society. And for it's like I was attending a talk the other day with India Madhavi, and she said to her, color is joy. And to some degree, I agree with her, color is energy. And it really creates a spark or an atmosphere of nurture. Color makes a difference. So we have to embrace that. And companies and architects are embracing that, but they just need help.
Yeah. Hasn't there even been a recent study that shows that the way a product is interpreted is heavily influenced by its color?
Yes, between 62 and 90%.
Wow. On a very pragmatic note, when you are approached by a large design company, for example, what is the very first question that you're asking yourself when you embark upon a new project?
The first question for me is to identify the function of the color. What context will it be working in? And what difference should it make in the context? Because before we know that, all colors are just speculation. And we need to work beneath that. And we need to find the right colors to thrive in the given context.
Hmm.
It's like when I say the function of color, you're immediately disturbed. Does a color really have a function? And I say yes. I call it the fourth dimension of the cube, actually. So if you think of three cubes, identical sizes, put next to each other, I paint them, let's say, deep, dark blue, bright, pure red, and then light, light yellow. And I put them maybe with 1 meter in between, and I ask you to look at them and choose one. So you will immediately choose one, and that means they aren't the same anymore. They've been disturbed by the fourth dimension, which is color, because with the color applied to the surface, they've been given a spatial size and a spatial way to interact with the room that will meet your senses and meet your body and create some kind of dialogue that you react on or you're feeling oppressed by. So they aren't the same anymore. And in that sense, it's not correct to say that color is just surface or decoration. It's much more than that. It's the fourth dimension of the cube.
How does this finely tuned relationship with or awareness of color that you have, Margrethe, help you with accessing your own emotions?
I actually don't need help accessing my own emotions. Actually, when I work in my studio, I'm dressed in neutrals and I have colors in my house, but I sometimes wish I didn't have that many because I'm disturbed by colors and I try to think clear when it comes to colors. But in the projects where I'm helping architects with their interior designs, what's interesting is how we can work with colors to activate a certain behavior and how certain colors will help them being energized or calm or feeling safe or cared for. So this is really one of the things I'm quite concerned about right now is to try to focus the choice of colors into a direction where they function as a way to support a certain behavioral pattern.
Do you have any examples of that at play in your own life?
Yes, I actually do. For 5 years, I suffered from a rather bad concussion and I had a lot of troubles with noise and strong light. And our living room at this time, it was white, a beautiful natural white. And there was a lot of plants and books. And in many ways, it's the kind of living room you will see in a magazine. And the thing is that it was so bright, it was faced south. So there was a lot of sunlight and a lot of things going on in terms of light reflections and all the colored books. And it was an open space, 2 big open doors and 4 kids at home, making a lot of noise, running around, screaming. And so it was a restless room, beautiful, but restless. And my brain was suffering. And I took the choice to paint the living room an earthy Venice red, Pompeian red. And I painted both the woodwork and walls and not ceiling, but all other surfaces in this particular red color. And it was amazing the effect it had. The kids to this day, we still have the color in our living room. It's like they lower their voice and they move a little more slow and they move closer. In a way, it's hard to explain, but it calms your senses. And it's so cozy and it's so embracing and warm and nurturing. And we just lower our voices, move closer. It almost feels like having a fireplace going on. So that was a particular moment of realization for me, the impact that color can have on the way we act in a room.
I'm curious in the way that you perceive color and how that's influenced by your synesthesia, which I'm loath to say is a condition because it's more like a neurological phenomenon.
Yeah.
Whereby rather than just experiencing through one of the 5 senses, you can experience multiple senses simultaneously, as I understand it. Can you explain a little bit about how you experience the world with this phenomenon?
I actually didn't know that I was one of the world's population who has this synesthesia, until a British journalist once said to me, are you sure you're not having the synesthesia? And I feel grateful for it, because to me, it's nothing special. It's just the way I see the world. But I think it sort of gives me a more sensitive experience of my surroundings, because I have several senses reacting on the same impulse. So maybe also more refined, but I wouldn't be able to compare. But it's just, to me, the way I see the world. And when I talk with others with synesthesia, they are all equally pleased with it as well. It's just a softer way to meet the surroundings, I think.
Mm. Do you think it has given you an edge with what you're doing?
Maybe it's given me an edge. I've spent some time focusing on it because I was curious, like in my collaborations with a musician and a chef, and maybe these two in particular. But when experimenting with my field of color and textile and trying to understand how to use it and how to be relevant to others, I went through a period of discovery and focusing on my synesthesia in a dialogue between these different fields. I'm not really sure how I use it today, actually, now you ask.
Well, if we look at one of those collaborations, the Y arpeggio print that you created in collaboration with Taitua, the renowned Faroese musician.
Yeah.
I'm really curious about that project and how it came about that you decided to work together, and what was the outcome of that collaboration?
Taitua is one of my best friends, and we go all the way back to high school. And we also lived together in both New York and here in Copenhagen. So very often late at night, we exchanged experiences during the day, and we soon discovered that he's a musician, I'm a creative designer, but we had a lot of similar experiences. You know, there's also different words that are the same in the Danish language, like klang, the quality of a tone, can have the same word in color when you talk about color and when you talk about music. And at some point, we decided, let's look into this. And I started researching a lot and actually discovered that we were quite many of us with synesthesia who's been doing that. And that's, I think, natural, because when Taitua played for me, all I saw was visuals. So he would play a tone and bing, the tone had a color in my mind. And when I researched on it, I came across this table of comparisons between others with synesthesia back to Newton. I think he was the first one in 1604 or something. And it was very interesting because, like, if you took the tone C, the table showed how many would compare this to the color red or blue. So there was a clear picture and I fit right into it. It was quite fantastic. And what Taito and I discussed was the fact that, let's say red, it has the lowest light wave energy. And that was the C. When you play the piano, C would be like the key center. And then you have D moving from that. So that makes sense in a way that we all connected C with red. And now you ask me, I'm not really sure to what degree synesthesia or the awareness of color and music played into it. But the fact was that it was very easy for me to create visuals to his music. And just interesting, after having done it, to discover that I was attuned to all the others with synesthesia.
And the finished product was literally a printed pattern that was a visualization of Taito's music?
Yes, and I named it iMusic, not from my description, but because I discovered that back to the Renaissance, there was such phenomenon as iMusic. They actually acknowledged the fact that we were able to listen to music through our eyes. Our eyes are musical in the same way as our ears. And that's also why we react to patterns in our surroundings or all kinds of rhythm. And we can see if, like, this painting is off in some way. It's because, like a musician, we have a way to experience our surroundings as a rhythm. So iMusic, it was a normal term back in the Renaissance. And yeah, well, it's a very interesting product in many ways, but also quite clever in the sense I'm not sure how many really understand it.
You have also worked with leading figures from the world of cuisine, fashion, visual arts. I'm curious from your perspective, Magaida, what is the key ingredient to a successful creative collaboration?
To listen. In order to collaborate well, you have to not be more than 50% of the collaboration. So you have to listen and to understand what's really at stake here. What's really the problem that we have to solve or the question we have to ask and find the common ground. And I think it's important to remind yourself to listen and not to just say, who am I and what can I do and what should we do? But be quiet for a while and allow the process to arise between the two parts. When you collaborate, it's important to pull back a little, to give room for not only the other part, but also the shared ground between you.
Hmm. Well, one project that you've completed on your own in previous years culminated in the publishing of a book, which was your journey to creating the definitive Nordic color palette, 276 colors.
Yeah.
What was your motivation to do that?
My motivation actually came from traveling around in the world, trying to understand other cultures' way of using colors. And I had to do that before I was able to see my own culture with more naked eyes. And I assume my motivation was really to get behind what I thought I knew about the way we use colors and find my own reason of how I am to select and work with colors in my own culture. And it was rewarding, I think, more for myself than maybe others. I'm not sure how much I was able to give to the readers, but for myself, it was a discovery that I have been carrying with me. And the beginning of understanding my premise of the book was that one day I was biking at Islandsbrücke, and it was at 4 p.m, I think, in January or February. And I didn't realize that it had become the blue hour because I was, I guess, occupied by thinking of different stuff. And I had to stop for red. And while I was there on my bike, on my right hand, there was a cafe. And I looked there and I felt immediately like drawn into the cafe, not because I wanted coffee, but because there were large windows facing the street and they had orangey kind of candlelight atmosphere with a very cozy energy coming out, meeting me in the street. And yeah, a lot of candlelights. As you know, Danes are quite obsessed with candlelight. And it was really interesting how I could feel like I need to go in there. And then the light became green and I biked again. And I realized that it had become the dark blue hour of afternoon. So there was this contrast between the orange color of the cafe and the blue, blue hour of afternoon. And that moment I understood, I think, what I call the Scandinavian identity. What is all this hygge about? To me, that moment, I realized it's about orange. And it's about the fact that so many weeks a year, months a year, we have quite a lot of darkness. And we are feeling oppressed by the darkness. It's the universe and the sky sort of, you know, lying like a big fog over our houses, our buildings, and our everyday lives of darkness and rain and everything. So in order to deal with this blue darkness, we gather around the orange light of candlelight. If you go back to the Western, let's say in American Westerns, they also sit under starlight and they sit close around the fireplace, the campfire. And that's how we are convincing ourselves that we are safe and that we are protected. We are together. We are nurtured. That's the orange color protecting us, like pushing away the danger from the universe. So this contrast of blue and orange is actually quite a big and important factor in the Scandinavian color scheme. That's one thing. And then the second thing I learned was the fact that 80% of our daylight in Scandinavia comes from indirect light. So it's reflections, not direct sun, 80%. And that allows us to have soft shadows and a multiple graduation of different tones of the shadow. So it's simply a fact that we can see more shades and different shades in the shadow than a given culture close to an equator will. So those two aspects were like my deeper understanding of how we work with color, how we see and perceive colors, and what kind of colors will thrive in our culture.
Mm. On your studio wall, I noted there's a written quote, "Color must be thought, dreamed, imagined." What do you get from those words as you reflect upon them on a daily basis, Margaida?
It's a quote from Gustave Moreau, and it's important for me because it reminds me that colors shouldn't just be seen as numbers or trends or indexes or practicalities or surface or anything like that. In order to create colors that make the difference and that create good kinds of energies, you have to dream them and imagine them to manifest their qualities. And I know it sounds strange, but when you work with colors, you will probably understand me. So you close your eyes and you start dreaming, and you start just to become an open color catcher, to catch the right color that comes to you. And then you imagine how you can transfer that from your imagination into the surface. And then you think in order to perceive it perfect. So it's like dream and imagine and think, and then you will be able to hopefully catch the right color. Don't just think it or select it.
Hmm. Well, just in closing, Margaida, as chief color catcher of the Nordic region, what would be the one challenge or encouragement you would offer to your peers? If you could boil it all down, what would you like your legacy to be?
My hope is that people will become more aware of how the color lives in the surface, and not just talking about the hue or how it's tinted or shaded, but talk about how it's physically manifested in the surface. And as an example, right now I'm very occupied by whites and how we can have beautiful whites in our surroundings. And like many others, for many years I've been buying white paint, an acrylic-based paint in a paint shop, like normal paint. And then you will have different paint brands like Ferron Ball or Equals, where you know that you will get a higher quality paint. And for many years, that's what took over. But right now, I'm rediscovering white as a pigment. So it started by reading a book about Le Corbusier and modernism, and the whole idea of modernism being the purification and distancing itself from the decorative Jugendstil, or in the beginning of the 19th century, all these years of the more the merrier. So they came up with the concept of white, but it just wasn't white as we know it. It was a creamy white. So Le Corbusier's basis of white was a pigment white, which is from the Champagne region. And what it is, it's a pigment made from mussel shells, and it's been chalked and grained. But when you look at it in a microscope, you will see the flakes of rainbows still from the mussel shells. So that also, like I'm looking at you now, but then you understand why white in the time of modernism wasn't white as we know it today. It was a white that in the surface would have small grains of flakes of mussel shells that would reflect and absorb light in a beautiful, beautiful way. And that specific white is what I'm taking into my praxis today, and I'm really working with it now because it's so rewarding. All the colors I mix from this white pigment and other pure and natural minerals and also inorganic pigments, they are so satisfying in an entirely different way than all the paints that I've gotten used to, where all the pigments are industrially made in a binder of acrylic. So they actually just like they're frozen. They are not able to breathe. I call it breathing colors. So if I'm to make a difference during my lifetime as a designer, I think my main focus will actually be to heighten the awareness of the fact that it's not just about color itself, it's about the ingredient of the color and how it's mounted or applied to the surface and how it breathes in the surface. That's important.
Mm.
So my hope is that people will be less calculated and more curious.
I think that's as good a challenging note to end on as any. Makaira, thank you so much for taking the time to share your story with us with such passion and insight.
Thank you for having me, Ben.
Nordic Portraits is a series by me, Ben Catford. The music was composed by Nina Liu and the visual identity by Copenhagen-based studio Frame. To learn more about today's guest and all the others from this season, visit nordicportraits.net. You can also follow us on Instagram and remember to rate and subscribe on iTunes so we can get the word out. Thanks for listening.